From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. What good people. If you've made a donation this week, I want to extend a very sincere thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, I urge you to make a tax-deductible contribution today. More information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Tuesday is the Catholic Feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe. Sundown Tuesday brings the start of the Jewish celebration of Hanukkah. This past week, I had the privilege of participating in a panel discussion presented by the invaluable organization Americans United for Separation of Church and State. The formal title was Separation Anxiety: Defending the Church-State Wall in the Age of Trump. I was joined on the panel by Mikey Weinstein, founder and president of the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, Pedro Irigoyen-Gray, a fellow with the International Academy of Trial Lawyers, and Maggie Garrett, legislative director of Americans United. The panel was moderated by Nina Burley, national politics correspondent for Newsweek magazine. On this week's show, I'm happy to be able to share some highlights from this panel with you. I also had the opportunity to record some one-on-one conversations, and you'll hear those as well. Those issues couldn't be more important or more timely than right now. I had the privilege of opening this discussion with remarks of my own. I'm glad to share those with you. Tonight I begin my presentation with a statement that I never before have made in public. The topic we have gathered to discuss, religious freedom, is in this moment as insecure and endangered as it was prior to the confirmation of the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. That observation is not hyperbole. Sadly, it is reality. Now, how could that be? Religious freedom and democracy are integrally related. Religious freedom has been called our nation's greatest gift to the rest of the world. How can I speak about the insecurity of religious freedom? For one thing, we have short memories when it comes to religious freedom. How soon we forget. Scores of people have forgotten the meaning, importance, and application of the guarantee of religious freedom in our nation. Thankfully, unlike us, the founders of this nation had good memories, long memories. They could not forget the Crusades that offered non-Christians the choice of converting to Christianity or dying immediately. How holy wars launched by those who considered themselves most holy, attempts at theocracies that ignored the importance of freedom of choice in any authentic religion decision, immigrants who came to this land to escape religious persecution, who once they were here and discovered that there was a faith of theirs that was in the minority, they began persecuting others as they had been persecuted. Cries for independence that turned into boasts of sectarian sovereignty. the so-called righteous burning of witches, and announcements of non-believers who were denounced and considered un-American. They couldn't forget that. The architects of this democracy knew that throughout history, every time institutions of religion and institutions of government have become entangled, both were compromised to the extent of losing their integrity. Religious freedom's never been secure in the United States. No sooner had the Constitution been adopted than a ragtag diversity of smart, courageous people, Jews, atheists, humanists, Baptist free thinkers, and others, united to demand an amendment to the Constitution that would assure religious freedom for every citizen. We dare not now allow the lies of revisionist historians to blind us to the meaning and importance of religious freedom so carefully defined in the First Amendment to the Constitution. Ours is a secular government. John Adams and other stalwart defenders of freedom wrote in Article 11 of the Treaty of Tripoli, "The government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion. Our founders appreciated religion, but they displayed no will to impose religion on our government or to allow our government to impose religion on anyone else. But my sense is that today we could not pass the First Amendment to the Constitution. Religious freedom is now in jeopardy of compromise or outright eradication." Now, why? How did that happen? In the face of growing religious pluralism and burgeoning diversity among the citizens of our land, we have seen a dangerous rise to majoritarianism that is being wielded like a sledgehammer in efforts to destroy the wall intended to separate the institutions of religion and government. President Taft correctly observed that the Puritans came to this country to establish freedom of their religion, not anyone else's religion. And many others saw it the same way. Today, the rapidly rising numbers of non-religious people in this land have given flames going again, flames of majoritarianism. President George Bush and members of the Supreme Court saw to it that they would announce in the public places of our country that religious freedom really ought to be designated as a states' rights issue that should be decided in each local community to allow the most prevalent religion in any location to prevail in making laws and regulations that could annihilate protection for minority opinions. After the crisis of 9/11, people were scared, severely afraid. Pervasive fear capitulated many people into saying that they would rather have security than liberty. And so the door was opened for changing such a unique and important item as religious freedom. A quick look at developments in the executive branch of our government is disturbing. Our past three presidents have supported government funding of religion. Bill Clinton signed several laws to establish charitable choice, laws that gave the government permission to use federal tax dollars to pay for charitable services through churches and other religious institutions. George Bush, of course, brought to us a faith-based office in the White House and began distributing government money to religious ministries. After failing to persuade the transition team of President-elect Barack Obama to do away with the faith-based office in the White House, I was asked to serve on President Obama's task force to study the constitutionality of the faith-based initiative. Immediately, however, the president took off the table the issue of protecting civil rights when it came to employment practices. And then came Donald Trump, who not only does not understand the United States Constitution, he shows contempt for it. Listen, a man who cannot distinguish an offering plate from a communion tray is not likely to know the danger of his love for the religious right and his support for making houses of worship become precinct conventions in which tithes and offerings are replaced by contributions to political campaigns. The United States Congress has not shown any reticence to keep its hands on what religious freedom is about. And need I tell you that the other segment of government has been destructive rather than productive in seeing to it that religious freedom is preserved. Well, that's where we've been, and that's where we are now. And I will close like I opened. Tonight, we gather at a moment in which religious freedom is as insecure and endangered as it was in the days prior to the confirmation of the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. There's more from the Americans United for Separation of Church and State Philadelphia panel still to come on this week's show. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. This week, we're bringing you highlights from a panel on defending the church-state wall in the age of Trump, which I participated in this past week in Philadelphia.
Our next speaker is Maggie Garrett. Maggie is Legislative Director for Americans United for Separation of Church and State. She is an attorney who's been working on church, state, and civil liberties issues for years, in the real trenches down in Alabama and in Georgia for the ACLU.
Good evening. My assignment was originally to talk about what is happening in church-state separation today, and I decided to divert, and I'm going to talk about, actually, I've decided to talk about yesterday. So all of these things happened yesterday in the world of church-state separation. I'm going to tell you about one thing that happened in Congress, one thing that happened in the courts, one thing that the Trump administration is doing. I'm sure all of you have heard about the tax reform bill. So what does tax reform have to do with church-state separation? There's two things in the tax bill that you probably haven't heard about because there's so many terrible things in this tax bill. First thing, school vouchers. Both the House and the Senate versions have provisions that create tax deductions that allow money to go to K through 12 schools. So I don't know if a lot of you know what 529 accounts are. They are accounts where you can put money away and you can save money for your child's college education. So you put money in there, and then when your kid goes to school, you can take money out and you can get a tax deduction of $10,000 a year for taking money out to spend on your kid's college education. Both the House and the Senate bills, the Senate bill actually was a Ted Cruz amendment, passed at 11:30 at night, and they had to bring Pence in to break the tie, because it was a tie vote, because Murkowski and Collins voted against it. This provision turns 529s into school voucher accounts. So you can use that money, you can take out to $10,000 tax-free a year to spend on your kid's K through 12 private school. So instead of taking money in and then giving money in the form of a voucher, instead what they're doing is we're just going to forego those tax dollars so you can spend money on a private religious school. This becomes even more troubling when you think about the fact that the tax bill also prevents you from getting a tax deduction for your state and local taxes. So what do your state and local taxes go towards? They go towards public schools. So you will no longer be able to take a tax deduction for the money that's funding your public schools, but you will be able to take a $10,000 a year deduction for funding private religious schools. Another provision in the tax bill, which actually keeps me up at night, is an attack on the Johnson Amendment. So the Johnson Amendment is a provision in the tax law that says that tax-exempt organizations, so think houses of worship, think the YMCA, think Americans United, groups you give money to that you get a tax exemption for and they don't pay taxes, those groups, because they do charitable work, cannot endorse candidates. That's what the law says now. The tax bill in the House, not in the Senate, but in the House, says that that's a bad idea, so we're going to let churches and all 501c3 tax-exempt organizations endorse candidates. So that is in the House bill. Now, how did we get here? Essentially, Donald Trump was in a room full of evangelical pastors, and he kept saying, you guys love me, I know you love me, why don't your churches endorse me? And finally they said, well, we can't, our churches can't endorse you. Of course, everyone around the room was endorsing him personally, but he wanted the churches to endorse them too, and so that he said, why can't you endorse me? And they said, well, there's this thing called the Johnson Amendment that says we can't, you know, use tax-deductible dollars to endorse candidates. And he said, well, then let's change that. So this is all coming from Donald Trump. So he has been pushing this idea. So he promised he would get rid of and destroy the Johnson Amendment. I'm not sure how they differ, but that's what he said he's going to do. So that is in the tax bill. So what does this mean if it's in the tax bill? The way it's in the tax bill says that all 501c3s and all houses of worship can make statements of endorsement. Now, that might sound narrow, but what it means is it can be in your sermon, it can be in your bulletins, you can put it on the website. If you're Notre Dame, you could call up your alumni association and say, hey, call in to check in, you should give us a donation, why don't you vote for Donald Trump, why don't you vote for Hillary Clinton? So it's going to create division within our houses of worship, it's going to create division within our tax-exempt organizations, we're going to have Republican soup kitchens and Democratic soup kitchens, and it's honestly going to turn our charitable organizations on their head. So this is something you can take action on. You can still write your senators and your members of Congress and say, keep the Johnson Amendment out of the tax bill. The second thing, and I'm going to have to go through these fast, you might have heard about Masterpiece Cake Shop. That was heard in the Supreme Court yesterday. In that case, there was a couple, they went to get a wedding cake. It was actually for their reception. They went to the cake person and the bakery and they said, oh, I'm sorry, we don't sell cakes to same-sex couples for their receptions. And they said, well, that's weird because the law says you have to sell me this cake. And the baker said, oh yeah, but I'm going to deny you your cake because of my religious beliefs and I can totally get away with that. We think, of course, that religion is a fundamental American value. Religious freedom is a fundamental American value, but you can't use religion to discriminate and harm other people. The Colorado Commission on Civil Rights agreed with us. The Colorado courts agreed with us. And now this case is at the Supreme Court. And so the baker is claiming, one, it's cake art, and it's my free speech rights, even though the cake is identical to the cake they would make for a straight couple. So it's cake art, and I have my religious freedom rights. So yesterday we had a rally at the Supreme Court. We filed a brief at the Supreme Court, and we argued, yes, you have religious freedom rights, but you can't use it to harm other people. And that is sort of the issue of the day in the church-state world, where they are turning religious freedom on their head. We think of religious freedom as a shield that protects you and protects your ability to express your religious beliefs and act as you want, but it only goes so far. It can't be used as a sword to hurt other people. And that's exactly what's happening in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case. And the consequences for this case are really huge. It's really not about cake. It is about whether businesses can say that they can use a religious claim to deny you services. So it could be a bakery today. It could be a hotel tomorrow. It could be your mortgage company the next day. It could be any of these entities. And it could be a gay couple today, and it could be an interfaith couple tomorrow. It could be someone just based on race. They could say, no Lutherans. They could say, I'm not serving Jews. They could say, I'm any of these things. Because if it's based on your religious belief, that really has no end, because you can't really question what a person's sincere religious belief is in the courts. And so if this cake baker wins, the consequences are dire. And then the third thing is what the Trump administration did yesterday. So speaking of women's health care, Yesterday, AU and a bunch of organizations, repro groups, LGBT groups, civil rights groups, on and on and on, filed formal disagreement with the Trump administration yesterday over its new birth control regulation. So Hobby Lobby, we all probably know what Hobby Lobby is. It's the Obama administration laws said that if you're an employer and you give health care to your employees, you have to cover birth control. But they said if you're a house of worship, you don't have to. If you're a religious organization, instead of providing it, what you can do is tell the government you have a religious claim that you don't want to provide it, and the government will provide it to women themselves. We didn't like that last caveat, but at least women were getting it through the government. Hobby Lobby sued. They said our religion and our craft store says that we cannot provide insurance coverage for women to use contraception. Now, who knows if the women were actually doing it? It's their free choice after that. But they said, we won't provide them that. They went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, yes, Hobby Lobby, you do not have to provide coverage for women to get contraception. But the reason you don't have to is because there's this thing that we already have for religious organizations where they can say no, and then they get coverage from the government anyway. So that's where Hobby Lobby was. Hobby Lobby didn't provide the coverage, but the government ultimately gave women coverage for birth control. The Trump administration's new regulations cut out that second part where the government's going to cover it anyway. Now what happens with these new regulations is any corporation, it could be, you know, a publicly shared corporation, any corporation can say, I'm going to make a religious or moral claim against providing insurance coverage for contraception, and then women just don't get it. There's no backup. There's no nothing. That is what the Trump administration just adopted, and so we made formal complaints there. So this is another use of religion to harm other people, to take away health care. And it's also a way of using religion to discriminate, because who is predominantly using birth control? It's women. And so this is another way to use religion to discriminate against women. So again, those are just three things in one day that Americans United is fighting. So we've got vouchers, we've got the Johnson Amendment, we've got using religion to discriminate. I don't want you to leave this part feeling like you can't do anything. You really can make a difference on the tax bill still. The Johnson Amendment language isn't in the Senate version, which makes it easier to keep out of the ultimate bill. So you can call your senators, you can call your representatives, and tell them that you don't want the Johnson Amendment repealed and undermined in the tax bill. Thank you.
There's still more to come from Philadelphia, coming at you in just a moment. If you miss any part of today's show, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to some topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows. All of that. Go to stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. Here's more from this past week's Americans United for Separation of Church and State panel discussion in Philadelphia.
I have a question for Maggie, because I'm really fascinated by Alabama. Once those allegations against Roy Moore started to come out, I thought, it's impossible. The people of Alabama will not send this man to Washington. But it doesn't look like that I'm going to be right about that. And I'm just completely baffled. And I wonder, since you put in some time down there, if you can talk about that at all.
I think actually Welton can answer this probably better than me. I'm going to take a stab at it first because I'm a girl from South Jersey. But I can say I'm actually not that surprised because I think for at least now, the ends justify the means, right? So why are the evangelicals rallying behind Donald Trump? Like, have they met Donald Trump? Have they read anything about him? Why are they connected? I just don't understand it. And I think it is because he is promising them what they want. He got them a Supreme Court justice. He wants to give them the Johnson Amendment repeal. He's pretty much giving them all of these things, the birth control. He's, you know, working on changing the rules even further, as Walton was talking about the faith-based initiative and how they would allow government-funded employment discrimination. He's now going to move that further, so it's not just employment discrimination, but it will be if you go to the soup kitchen funded by the government, they can discriminate against you, or, you know, they can get money to take people who are trafficking victims and say, well, yeah, I'm going to take the money, but I'm not going to provide reproductive health care because it violates my religion. And they will say they have a religious freedom right to get that money and refuse services. So I think it's because the ends justify the means. And so if they can, I know it comes down to abortion, it comes down to tax reform, because Jesus really talked a lot about tax reform. And so I think that's it. But Walton, you have more insight into the South.
The religious right was primarily a movement from the top in which leaders who were more political than they were religious, though some were religious, saw how decisions had been made on Vietnam, on civil rights, on other issues by going through government. Those leaders went in and said, we're losing the battle for saving America. And what we've got to do is use the same tools, methods, strategies that these other people are using. The membership of the religious right has been for a long time not those upper echelon people with authority, but really good American people who wanted to see a better nation. And they were manipulated. They were trained that the end justifies the means, and they bought into an understanding of religious freedom that said, and this may be the most important thing I'm going to say, an understanding of religious freedom in which they were convinced religious freedom meant they could do that. Everything they were doing. That's the answer to that question. The implications of the answer to that question are people who are now understanding a brand new definition of religious freedom are in control of this country. And it is no longer about the two clauses in the First Amendment to the Constitution. It is to say, if this is my religion, I can do anything I want to do in the name of this religion. Mm-hmm. That's where we are.
What will you think the ultimate consequence of Trump acknowledging Jerusalem as the Israeli capital will be? And can we do anything about it?
I can tell you that the people that have tremendous control over our United States military see this as though they are watching a Hollywood movie. And this is part of the game plan. I mean, the establishment of Israel in 1948 was foretold by their version. And, of course, the fact that Jerusalem is now the capital, we're going to be moving our embassy, however fast that's going to happen from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, it continues the game plan. And what is that game plan? It's a game plan of fundamentalist Christian, what's known as dominion Christianity, theocracy, pushing away democracy, which is antithetical to this concept. And the whole game plan is to end this world. We've been here long enough. What do we need to do to create and serve our version of Jesus Christ as an accelerant and a lubricant to bring back this weaponized version of Christianity? The price will be paid with the snuffing out of lives and with the massive oceans of blood. It's just a matter of time. The Palestinian Authority has called for 3 days of rage. Watch 3 decades starting today.
The president doesn't understand the purpose of the people who were pushing him to do this. Those people want to Christianize that whole area of life and do away with any religion other than Christianity. And it does form a hope for the end time at which Jesus will return. Jews will have one opportunity to become Christians, and if they are not Christians, then they're killed. That's the theology.
Bringing it back home, On Monday, a Nevada federal district court ruled that religious humanism is not a religion under the Constitution. The court cited cases that defined religion as a belief in and reverence for a, quote, supernatural power accepted as the creator and governor of the universe. Reverend Gaddy and Ms. Garrett, is religious humanism protected under the Free Exercise Clause of the U.S. Constitution?
I think it's pretty clear that when they say freedom of religion, whether it's the Constitution or federal laws, they mean the right to believe or not to believe, they are equally protected. And so I am not actually familiar with this case that came down on Monday. I'd have to check it out and give my real expertise on it to say much more than that. But yes, clearly, you have the right to believe or not believe. There are some debates, actually, I would say, even within the atheist community, whether or not to refer to humanism, atheism, et cetera, as religions, or whether or not that is offensive to members of the community to say that they are the same. So I know that in the community, there are different ways of talking about it. But as far as the courts go, yes, you have the right to believe or not believe, and that is what is protected.
And from the vision of religion as we have known it through history, religion is a free choice that every person makes. And if a person is not free to not believe, they are not free to believe.
If I may briefly, I represented mainstream science in the 2005 Kansas Evolution hearings. Fully grown men and women masquerading as scientists, telling me the earth was created at or about the same time the Sumerians were inventing beer. It was absolute nonsense. But one of their key issues was this humanistic materialism, this notion that if one focuses on the material world, that there is therefore a religion, which is going to be an interesting issue as to how those two are compared. And because materialism, humanistic materialism, is in fact a religion, intelligent design deserves to be permitted as an alternative theory in the science classroom. Mm-hmm. That's a battle that's still ongoing, and you need to keep a close eye on that because the majority of textbooks in the United States come out of Texas. And how Texas goes, which is not really a great sign of hope, is what significant number of American kids are going to be reading in their textbooks about science.
You know, the Koch brothers are actually financing preaching that environmentalists are green witches, or that there's a sort of a paganistic aspect to climate change in the discussion of the environment. But it is actually financed by the oil and gas industry. Here's a kind of a spiritual question. I guess we can start with Reverend Gaddy and move along. How do we teach moderates, normies, and average people, as well as conservatives, to extend empathy beyond their neighborhood, race, and church? What's in it for them? How do we motivate empathy to build the wall back up stronger and to protect democracy?
We have a history in which citizenship has become out of date. Not many schools are teaching citizenship anymore. When we lost the teaching of citizenship, we lost the meaning of patriotism, and we lost the meaning of democracy. And so we have at least two or three generations, at least, who don't understand democracy, who don't understand patriotism, and who don't understand the first freedom of this nation, which was religious freedom. Empathy comes when you care, and you don't care if you don't know. And there has been a kind of inverted focus in many religions, and people care only about people like them. And we even hear that people who are not like them are not really religious, even if they say so. Mahatma Gandhi said that the quality of a nation, the goodness of a nation, is measured by how it treats its weakest members. People in religion and people as good citizens ought to understand that. Now, we have the challenge of teaching empathy and embodying empathy in the administration of a president who doesn't know what empathy is.
Because of the inherently authoritarian structure of the U.S. military, challenges to constitutional freedoms may manifest there more quickly than in the civilian sector. What do you see as the most prevalent threats today, and how have they changed in just the past year?
I can tell you that since it became clear that Trump was going to be the presumptive nominee sometime in July of last year, we almost immediately saw an influx of clients. And as my wife can tell you, who is here tonight, they come by smoke signal, carrier pigeon, text, phone calls all around the clock. And by November 8th, we saw another spike, obviously, and then on January 20th, and it just hasn't stopped. What we need to do to stop this is that we need people court-martialed and thrown into jail in places like Leavenworth. When you tell someone in the military, I've said this many times, that you lack integrity, character, honor, honorability, courage, and intelligence because of your chosen religious faith or lack thereof, there is no difference between that and telling someone that they're stupid because of the color of their skin or because they were born without a penis. Does everybody understand this? And so until we actually get people prosecuted for this, it never happened under Bush. We were hoping under Obama. We had a little bit of success there. And now people are being rewarded for nothing more than bigotry and prejudice against people who are the other. My father passed away a week ago, and during his eulogy, I remember the most important thing he ever taught me was when I was 6 years old. I was a first grader, and I watched two third graders beat up a second grader. These are boys that were bigger than me and older than me. I mentioned that at dinner. Didn't think anything of it. It just was kind of an interesting thing. And my dad looked at me and said, well, what did you do about that? I was surprised by the question. I said, I didn't do anything. They're older and bigger than me. And then he asked me, what would you have done if that was one of your brothers out there? You know, well, that changed things. I would have gone in there swinging. And I was 6 years old. I still didn't get it. And after dinner, he came into my room and he said, do you think the person that was getting beaten up was probably somebody's brother? I said, yes, sir. Before bedtime, he came back in and he said, how about this? The next time you see somebody do that, maybe you can be that person's brother for just a minute or two. I was six, but I got it. And I don't know how you get somebody who's infused and marinated in white, male, straight, Protestant, over the age of 40 privilege to understand this stuff, but we can't give up. The most important thing that I know of is education.
All right. This is a political question, and I guess we'll throw it to Maggie because you're in Washington, but then anybody else can jump right in because I think you all have thoughts on this. And I do, too, because I cover it. U.S. demographics is changing away from white male Christians. Is this why there is so much backlash right now?
Yes. People look around and they see people next to them who don't look exactly like them, and that, like, makes them scared. They're scared of the unknown. I think that there is backlash on church-state separation issues because people are gaining rights. So I have this T-shirt that says civil rights aren't pie. Someone else getting a piece of it doesn't mean that you don't get any pie. So people see other people getting rights, and they think that is taking it from them, rather than it being like, no, actually, we all have the same rights. So I think there is backlash because LGBT people are getting rights as they should. I think there is backlash because, as it should be, there are more people who are visible who are not mainstream or evangelical Christian. They are more open, they are more seen, as they should be, and I think that makes some people afraid. There are more people of color that makes people afraid. And so I think it is backlash against what they think is the unknown. And they think that, again, it's sort of when you have the privilege of getting everything your way, sometimes when you don't get your way, you think that you're being oppressed. And that isn't, of course, what is happening.
There are a lot of questions about why this information isn't more readily known. So I'm going to throw out this question. How do you get this information out? I've never heard of the military problem, for example. And there's another question about when we hear religious freedom in the media, it's always from the perspective of restricting reproductive health care, but not from the perspective of the religious freedom of the individual. Why do I not hear people in the media calling them out on it? But what are your thoughts on getting this information out and making sure that everybody, what can people do to get their friends and neighbors aware of what they've just seen here?
Well, of course, we're doing that tonight. That's the whole purpose behind what Bill Wiener does to help. This is our fourth one. We want to do many more of these. It's really hard in this day and age when everybody can be a blogger to get the word out. And part of the problem is many people eat at the same restaurant of issues day in and day out. You know, they get towards the end of the week and they're thinking college football, or they're thinking NBA, or they're thinking NFL. They don't open up. They're not exposed to it. It costs an awful lot of money to carry your message out there from a standpoint of advertising, or, you know, you've got a million chirping birds. It's really hard. And particularly now when, you know, you go to any website and there is the news cycle now, and Nina, you know this very well. Back in the day, there was a daily news cycle. Now it's a nanosecond news cycle. It just changes constantly. So if you feel it individually, if it affects you individually in your own family, that's when you'll start watching.
Something really simple you can do to put a plug in for AU is sign up for our action alerts. So if you go to AU.org, we'll have a place where you can sign up for action alerts. If you were on our listserv today, you would have gotten an email that said, call or email your senators and representatives and tell them this about the Johnson Amendment. Last week, we were sending them out. We were sending things out about the 529 voucher things. We sent out something so that you could have submitted your own comments about the Trump birth control regulations, and we would have submitted them. We actually went to Health and Human Services with a large box of them yesterday. So there are ways that you can do it sort of just immediately. So my executive director, Barry Lynn, just retired. We did a video talking about, you know, what do we have to do going forward? And when they asked me what I wanted to say about the future, what I said was our biggest battle is that we have to win back the term religious freedom, because it has been changed into something that it just isn't. And so, I mean, I take that as, you know, as AU's legislative director, as one of my main goals is to try to sort of change the hearts and minds of people and take back this word to mean what it means. It's supposed to mean. It is not supposed to mean using religion to discriminate, or, as Walton said, just getting your way because of your religion. So I think that is our biggest battle ahead.
You can get that also, some of the same things on the website of the Interfaith Alliance, where I was. My successor carries that same passion. And I happen to think that, Maggie, you've already heard what I said about that. I too, think that's the most important thing. What's different today is that there was a day when people just said, well, what is religious freedom? Today, everybody knows what religious freedom is. Sadly, it's what everybody thinks it is, and it's not. It's very clear in the Constitution. The one other thing I'd say is it is going to take courageous people in responsible places to speak truth, not to power. The power now knows the truth, to speak truth to their neighbor. We're bringing you highlights of a panel discussion on church-state separation that took place this past week in Philadelphia. I spoke with Mikey Weinstein, founder and president of the Military Religious Freedom Foundation. Mikey, you are the preeminent friend of religious freedom for all people who are concerned about religious freedom in the military. You have done such a great job that I always admire what you've done and thank you for what you've done. What is the most recent case that you've had, and how important is it?
First of all, thank you for those kind words, and that is huge, coming from a giant in the separation of church and state civil rights fight, which I consider you to be, and so many people do, Welton. We probably average a new client case pretty much every 2 hours around the clock, and it's been that way for a long time. Late last night, we went over 53,000. It sounds like McDonald's, you know, 8 billion served. But our most recent case actually happened when I was flying out here yesterday from Albuquerque. We have 14 U.S. Army soldiers that were ordered by their commander, ordered to come to a mandatory Christmas, not holiday party. They were ordered to bring their entire families, and the unit has over 160 troops in it. But these 14 were handpicked by the commander, the majority of whom, by the way, are not Christians, to learn and to sing in unison, Come All Ye Faithful, at the event. that got back to us very quickly. Fortunately, one of the more senior officers in this in the command has had experience with us through the years. A quick phone call to this very senior officer made it clear this was going to be stopped. But the fact that it even happened and the fact that the troops had to come to us for this help, you know, just shows how toxic the atmosphere is in the military. And if you're even being gently evangelized in the U.S. military by your superior, get the hell out of my face, sir or ma'am, is not an option for you. So they come to us because we basically provide our clients AARP, and not the one that you're thinking about, but anonymity action results in protection. So that's
is that typical that whatever's gone wrong has gone wrong with a higher officer?
Yes. Yeah, the chain of command has been inextricably intertwined with a type of Christianity that you are well-versed with, known as dominion or fundamentalist Christianity. And I differentiate that from evangelical Christianity because we have many evangelicals in our organization. They're clients. They donate to us. They both want to follow the Great Commission to get people to become Christians like them. But evangelicals will say, look, I have to follow the Constitution and all the case law associated with that and all the directives, instructions, and regulations from the Pentagon in how I do this. Mm-hmm. Whereas fundamentalists say there is no time, there is no place or manner in which we can be constrained from our zeal to follow the Great Commission of Mark, 28:15, Matthew 16:15, and get you into the kingdom.
You're not supposed to quote the Bible while we're talking.
Sorry about that. I'll work on that.
Maggie, one other question. This has been a monumental task, and it's taken a lot of your time and energy and money. Is it getting better, or is it getting worse? And if it's getting worse, what's causing it?
It was getting better. For 8 years, it was slowly getting better. When it became clear that Donald Trump was going to be the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party, we started seeing a marked change, and we are now at a point where we're seeing literally double the amount of client cases coming in. So in July of last year, it started getting bad. November 8th, that evening, it was a turning point. January 20th, and each day, it just gets worse and worse. When Trump tweeted or retweeted those videos, the anti-Muslim, Islamophobic videos the other day. We had Islamic members of the military coming to us. A young soldier who has a brother and sister also in the U.S. Military. They're not American citizens yet. They've been promised expedited American citizenship if they put on the uniform. Can you imagine how that made them feel to have one of their senior NCOs tout the fact that the President of the United States made it clear that they, because they're Muslims, are a security risk, they have no honor, and they need to be watched very, very carefully. We have seen this train leave the station before, you know, hello, Third Reich, and I can stop right there.
So what would you want our listeners to know succinctly about religious freedom and how it fares in the military?
The military is a very separate and different, distinct society. Unless you've been in or you've had a family member, it's hard to remember how, you know, brutal, tribal, adversarial, and communal it is. What I would ask them to be is to be standing by to help and not to be bystanders. It's as simple as that.
Thank you, man.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Here are some thoughts I heard from Pedro Iranagaray, a fellow with the International Academy of Trial Lawyers.
Pedro, since we've got to know each other, have such great admiration for what you do, for what you have done across recent years. I know your commitment is to civil rights. You have done so much work for Planned Parenthood as their attorney and helped so many different people. Where did you get the passion for civil rights?
Actually, it's more than that. It's a passion for justice.
Mm-hmm.
I came from Cuba. We lost our freedom because we were irresponsible with our government. And holding government accountable seems to me to be one of the most profoundly important duties of any citizen, and the privilege of being able to do so within the judicial system has been extremely rewarding to me.
Mm-hmm.
That's my passion.
What is the greatest concern you have right now about justice for all people?
My greatest concern is that I fear the current administration in what I can characterize as an unwise maneuver, is placing into the federal judiciary individuals that are not flexible. It's okay if we disagree. It's okay if we have different perspectives. But we need to be very careful how we choose our judiciary, because they're the backstop. They're the independent branch of government that tells the president or the legislature or any of us what you're doing is not constitutionally approved. And we need to entrust that power, that authority, that wisdom to women and men that are highly qualified and respectful of one another.
How do you talk to someone who doesn't understand that?
I think, unfortunately, we are so divided that talk immediately on both sides, mm-hmm. because I've seen people that I believe are of ideas similar to mine that are unable to engage in conversation someone who differs. Mm-hmm. And a very wise person once told me, conversation is to friendship as light is to stained glass. And for a minister like you, who has such wisdom, such caring, such awareness of important concerns in our nation, I think that that is a good analogy, because you converse with people, and you're a minister, and you put the light on others' stained glass.
I hear all the time people say religious freedom is just a theory. That's something for some people that are esoteric and just want to deal with something like that. Or religious freedom is not what it used to be, or all of us would be able to do exactly what we want to do. Tell our listeners how important religious freedom is to you and why.
Oh, listen, go to the Declaration of Independence. And in the Declaration, the words, the pursuit of happiness, are enshrined. Now, those words were not chosen without a great deal of thought. One cannot be happy if one is denied the basic right of freedom of thought and freedom of expression. And unless government has an inherent state interest, religion, expression of religion, must remain free. It has to, for us to remain free, because the moment we begin to exclude anyone because they're not of the right religion or the right group within a religion, and whenever government steps into that arena, one thing I can guarantee, both the church and the state are going to get hurt. Mm-hmm. That separation is there for a very important reason. We must protect religion from government, and we must protect government from religion.
Listen, keep up the good work.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. In the gridlock our public rhetoric has become, it's more important than ever to amplify voices of reason and civil discussions the way we do right here on State of Belief. Please subscribe to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to tune in next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That state of belief.
It's time we stop. catch that sound. Everybody look what's going on.